Groomed to follow in the footsteps of his father, founder of the Baskin-Robbins empire, John Robbins chose a different path for himself, becoming a social activist and fierce advocate for plant-strong diets and compassionate living. John Robbins is the author of The Food Revolution, Diet for a New America, Reclaiming Our Health, and The New Good Life. His life and work have been featured on the PBS special Diet for a New America, and he has won numerous awards for his pioneering work, including the Rachel Carson Award, the Albert Schweitzer Humanitarian Award, the Peace Abbey's Courage of Conscience Award, and Green America's Lifetime Achievement Award. Robbins' latest book, No Happy Cows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Food Revolution, is a wide-ranging collection of essays on the state of food politics today. Here he has gathered and updated his most talked about Huffington Post blog posts and mixed them together with some brand new writing on our food future. Among the topics he covers in this book are fair trade coffee and chocolate, the debate around soy foods, grass-fed organic and conventional beef, the rise in obesity in America, and the early onset of puberty, as well as the safety of our food supply. And I'm very pleased to be joined by John Robbins. Hello, John.
Hello. Glad to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining me today. So what was your overall goal and purpose in putting together this new book? Did you intend it as a sort of personal guide to eating healthfully, or more as a guide to help people connect with resources that might help them to advance our collective health?
Well, both of those and something else as well. I see a collision taking place. There are two forces, massive forces in our society that are in conflict with one another and even at war with one another right now. And let me explain what I'm talking about. On the one hand, I see industrial agriculture, Monsanto, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, corporate factory farms and feedlots, and a tremendous financial machinery that's profiting massively from producing foods that are cruel to animals, that are in their production, that are unhealthy for the people that eat them, and that are unsustainable to the planet. In fact, polluting poisoning our Earth at a level that is egregious. It's a truly unhealthy food system. On the other hand, though, I see another force, which is the collective power of many individuals who are waking up to this tragedy, wanting to take a stand against it, wanting to eat food that's healthy, that is produced in a way that is in harmony with the earth and the creatures that the earth sustains, wanting to eat in a way more organically, more locally grown, less processed foods. If they're going to be eating animal products, they want from pasture raised or free range or humanely raised animals and humanely slaughtered. They don't want to participate, and in fact, they want to oppose the power of industrial agriculture. These two forces are at war, and I'm both, in writing No Happy Cows, I am both reporting on that war and taking a stand. I'm a journalist, and I'm also an activist, and I really do feel that the time to just talk about these things as if they didn't impact us at the most intimate level is over. So I am really actually taking a side here and promoting actions that will shift that fight in the direction of victory for those of us who want an agricultural system that we can look at and see a reflection of our humanity rather than our predatory behavior.
And I'd like to talk about that new paradigm you're talking about that people are becoming aware of, and some of these terms like free range and humanely raised, and also how agribusiness is impacting us. But one of the first things I wanted to talk about is this revolving door that you refer to a couple of times in the book between agribusiness and government agencies that are supposed to be regulating that business. I'm wondering if you could talk about this and how this affects food systems in our country, as well as how ordinary citizens can stand up to that kind of power.
Well, yeah, there are many aspects to that. One example is a man named Michael Taylor. Michael Taylor has gone back and forth from positions at Monsanto, where he has been a vice president, where he's been an attorney, where he's been a lobbyist, where he's been a member of the board, where he's been one of their most highly paid executives, to positions in government, where he has been appointed during the Clinton administration and then again during the Obama administration, to key positions. He has, in his governmental authority, had more to do with green-lighting genetically engineered foods than any other human being on Earth. And he's done so without, and he's made determinations, he's made decisions and authorizations that have led to the widespread use of genetically engineered seeds in our food supply without labeling and without testing. This is a an action that this man has almost single-handedly perpetrated on the public. He has had help, but he has certainly been a singular force in it, and this is a man who has worked for Monsanto at the highest levels of executive position. In between his stints at various positions in the FDA and in the food governing structure of the federal government.
So he's gone back and forth between working for Monsanto and working for the FDA.
Yes, back and forth four different times. Back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
And he's made key decisions. He's made key decisions that affect Monsanto and that affect consumers.
Yes, because Monsanto is, of course, and I assume our readers know this, but maybe they don't, I'll say it. Monsanto, the company he's been working for, is the leading producer of genetically engineered seeds, biotech, transgenic, GMOs, these are all terms that mean essentially the same thing, that are being grown and used in our food supply today.
So, again, how can ordinary people stand up to this kind of power? You have corporations and government hand in hand here, and what we get to go to the polls every 4 years and vote for a Democrat or Republican. I mean, where is the power with ordinary folks?
Well, it isn't going to come every 4 years by voting because, you know, here the Obama administration has been just as bad, and the Clinton administration was also in this regard as the Bush administrations. We haven't seen an administration in a long time that acknowledged the importance of low-input sustainable agriculture, of local agriculture, of family farms, of agroecology, of systems of food production that are the type of thing that people who shop at farmers markets want to see, that people who buy organic food want to see, that people who go to natural food stores want to see, that people who want their food to be produced with respect for the environment want to see. And yet the numbers of such people are growing, and I do take some inspiration from that. And that is one of the things then that individuals and families can do is to change where you shop for food. And as much as possible, if you can go to a local farmer's market where you're buying direct from the grower, where there aren't a lot of middlemen in between, where you can be sure that the food is organic if you wish it to be, where you can certify and verify that it's not genetically engineered, that's so important. And if you can't go to farmers, if you can grow stuff yourself, that's even better, but not all of us have that availability. But local farmers markets, another option that people can do is to join a CSA. Those initials stand for Community Supported Agriculture, CSA. And these are arrangements where you make it an agreement with a farmer, a local farmer, and you pay so much a month, and then he delivers or she delivers to you, or you may have a pickup place, but they provide for you a bundle of food, fresh fruit and vegetables every week for the growing season or the duration that you've agreed to. And it's really a wonderful way to, in effect, be an investor and even, you might even say, a partner, you know, in a local farm. You get the food at its freshest, you get it at its most nutritious, you get it at its most flavorful, and you form a link to the earth and to the farmer who's growing your food. We've become so alienated in so many ways from our food sources, from how it's produced and who produces it. And these are ways, local farmers markets and CSAs, of overcoming that alienation.
What about cost, though? Organic, buying organic does cost more, and sometimes even shopping at the farmer's market can cost more. One of your recent articles in the Huffington Post was about how Twinkies are cheaper than fresh produce. So it's not just consumer choices, but what about attacking some of the underlying issues that make, you know, Twinkies cheaper than produce?
You have to work on all levels. One of the things that I say to people who are concerned about spending the extra money for organic food is, of course, it's a personal choice, and people will spend their dollars as they choose, but it is, we spend a lower percentage of our GDP and of our personal income and of our discretionary income in this country on food than any nation in the history of the world. We also spend a higher percentage of our GDP, of our personal spending and discretionary spending, on healthcare than any other people in the history of the world. We are also the fattest people in the history of the world. We have the highest levels of obesity and of morbid obesity of any industrialized country in the history of the world. And there's linkages between these facts. And so when you start to eat healthily and possibly pay more for healthy food, nutritious food, you may be much healthier as a result and save money on these other costs that sometimes can bankrupt people, healthcare costs. Actually, they're disease care costs. We have a misnomer. We call it a healthcare system. It's a disease care system is what it is. But then we also need to work on the political level. Right now, Congress is debating the Farm Bill. They will be throughout the summer. It's a complex document. It's many, many hundreds of pages. There's many details to it.
Billions of dollars involved as well, correct?
Oh, many billions. Many billions. And most of it is subsidies to big ag, to industrial agriculture. There is a pittance to organic. There's a pittance. We need to not only level the playing field, in my opinion, we need to tilt it in the right direction so it's easier for people and cheaper for people to buy healthy food. If we did that, we could go a long way to solving the healthcare crisis we're in. I mean, right, the Supreme Court is going to be ruling any day now on Obamacare, of course. But in all the and that issue has become incredibly divisive and vitriolic and partisan but what I never hear mentioned is the one thing that would reduce healthcare costs across the board, and that is if we supported people in eating more healthfully. Right now, the cheapest calories in the supermarket and at the restaurant are always the least healthy ones. And that is the product of government policies. That is the product of decisions made by people like Michael Taylor that support the Grocery Manufacturers Association, that support the Biotech Industry Organization, which is Monsanto's trade lobby, in profiting massively from the foods that are least healthy for us.
So you're not just saying that Americans need to choose a healthier diet, which would put all the responsibility on individual choices. You're saying that the government needs to take certain actions in order to help Americans choose a healthier diet and make that more affordable rather than
Absolutely.
Subsidizing, you know, big ag over more local or organic. Is that
Absolutely.
What you're saying?
Now, I'll give you a couple of examples. What if we were to tax pesticides and use that revenue to lower the cost to subsidize organic food? That's an example of what I mean by tilting the playing field in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
What if we were to tax soda pop and other junk food and use the revenue from that to subsidize, lower the cost to the consumer of fresh fruits and vegetables?
Mm-hmm.
We could tax white bread and use that income to lower the cost to the consumer of whole wheat bread. This is tax shifts that would do it. There are other things too. Right now, junk food manufacturers, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, target kids with advertising that they spend tens of billions of dollars a year on. And these are ads they're deliberately marketing to children, and sometimes to very young children. And the foods that they're advertising are the worst ones. They're the least healthy ones. Now, we have an epidemic of obesity and diabetes in our children today. But they spend this money because they know they hook these kids. They get them hooked on the brands and the brand identification, and they stay with it for the rest of their lives. This is very powerful advertising. We should prevent this. I think we should ban. We should criminalize. We should make it illegal for food companies to market unhealthy foods to children. These are kids who we have to protect them. Failure to do so is actually colluding in child abuse. And I don't think that language is too strong. You look at these children who are way overweight and very unhealthy. Their body image, their self-image is terrible. They don't feel good in their body. They can't concentrate and learn. They can't focus. Their sense of themselves has no self-respect in it, or hardly any. And then they act that out in all kinds of ways that are burdensome to them and to their families and to our society. It may involve criminality at some point. We don't have to go that route. We could protect these kids, or protect all of our kids. We could help all of our kids to eat healthy food. And if we did that, we'd have such a better society in so many ways.
But
and that is stop these companies from targeting these kids with this junk food.
Well, what about the company's argument, McDonald's and some of these other big fast food giants, that it's really a parental responsibility, not theirs, that this is, the parents should be controlling what the children eat?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because, yes, parents should control what their kids eat, but these ads undermine the ability of parents to do that. It's a deliberate strategy. In the advertising industry, there's a term for it. It's called the pester factor. And they've determined that more than a third of times that people go to fast food companies, it's because a child was nagging, pestering, that they go there. Go to the Dairy Queen, go to the McDonald's, go to the Taco Bell, go to the Burger King. And the reason the kids do pester so much is because they've been subjected to, they've been bombarded by this advertising. So to say that you shouldn't prevent the advertising because the parents should make the decision, when the advertising is undermining the parental authority to make that decision. Every parent knows this. If you're trying to raise a kid in our society today to eat healthfully, but they're surrounded by junk food ads, they start to pester you. They want to fit in. They want to, and the food is convenient and it's inexpensive and it's very tasty and it's all gimmicky and it's marketed to the max.
Toys and all that.
Exactly.
Play
and,
places.
And what happens, parents' ability to control what the child eats and to get them started in a healthy way with a healthy food foundation, a healthy relationship to food, is completely eviscerated by the ads. So for the companies that are doing those ads, that are producing those ads and paying for them, to say, oh, we should be allowed to do this because parents it's their responsibility. That's a scandal.
So they actually refer to it as the pester factor in the industry. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they do. And they design their ads deliberately to increase the pester factor, to accelerate it, to enlarge it, to make it more effective. They depend on the pester factor. They seek to create and accentuate the pester factor. That's what those ads are designed to do.
So you would want government regulation, or you would want a ban on this targeting of children by fast food companies,
yes,
with their ads. Doesn't government regulation of advertising, or things like Mayor Bloomberg in New York's campaign to limit the sale of large sodas and other sugary drinks and things like that as a way of addressing healthcare issues like obesity, isn't this infringing on people's freedom of choice? Is it really the role of the government to police what people eat?
No, it's not the role of the government to police what people eat, but it is the role of the government to police what corporations do, and require that their advertising be honest and be in the public interest. Bloomberg's proposal is a very minimal one. It would prevent soda pop from being sold in the city of New York, 32-ounce containers. People could still buy two 16-ounce containers if they wanted to, 16-ounce jars or bottles.
But
or
they complain that it would cost more to do.
Yeah, it might. You know, Bloomberg, it's a tiny, tiny step in the right direction, in my opinion. The risk of that, actually, is that it's such a tiny step that if it were taken and it didn't do any good, because it might not do much good at all, it's such a tiny step, that then people say, oh, see, it didn't do any good, so forget the whole idea. I would like to see all soda pop taxed. In California, Bill Monning has proposed this repeatedly. It hasn't been passed, primarily because of the lobbying of PepsiCo and Coca-Cola. And these companies don't want that tax placed on their products, but we should do it. And that would raise the price of it, and it would deter consumption of it by making it more expensive. But then we could use that revenue to lower the cost to the consumer of healthy foods. And that's the important thing. We need to turn this around so it's easier to do the right thing. Right now, it's easier to do the wrong thing. It's cheaper to buy the unhealthy food. Right now, the cheapest calories is soda pop.
Mm-hmm. People are also confused by some of the advertising. For example, they're trying to make a healthy choice or humane choice. And as you mentioned in your book, the California Milk Board put forward these Happy Cow ads in California to lead people to believe that, you know, some above 90% of dairy farmers in California are family, quote, family farms, assuming the family farm is going to be more humane to the cows. And then you have Coca-Cola promoting these vitamin waters, as you mentioned in the book, as healthy beverages. And people are sometimes confused when they're kind of confronted with this type of what you basically describe as false advertising. Can you talk about how people can kind of navigate these claims and some of these advertisements, as well as I'd like to talk about some of the labels like free range or humanely raised and things like that. But what are your thoughts on people kind of navigating these ad campaigns?
Well, we need to educate ourselves, and this is one of the reasons I wrote No Happy Cows. And one of the things I do all the time in all my articles and speaking is to try to help people know what's going on, because the companies lie. I titled the book No Happy Cows, by the way, because there are no happy cows in industrialized agriculture. And yet, as you mentioned, the California Milk Producers Association has an ad campaign, a very expensive one. They're spending over $100 million this year on it, and they have been doing it each year, to convince people, to tell people that happy cows come from California. And the California dairy industry is centered in the San Joaquin Valley. It's in dry feedlots. These dairies have as many as 20,000 cows. These animals never see a blade of grass in their entire lives. It's a far cry from Wisconsin, by the way, which used to be America's dairy state, but California now produces much more. In Wisconsin, most of the cows are pastures, and there's a lot of rainfall there. We've situated our dairies in a part of the state that gets very little rainfall, and they're in dry feedlots. It's the opposite of what the ads present. Now, I'm actually involved in a lawsuit against the California Milk Producers Association, and here's why. If you sell a product, broccoli, as organic, and it isn't, it's grown with pesticides, that's criminal, that's illegal. And that's exploiting the people who would pay more money for organic broccoli. They value that, they don't want to have pesticide residues in their bloodstreams, they don't want to see farm workers subjected to these poisons. They want to protect the environment. They want to protect the farm worker. They want to protect their health. And so they're willing to, they have that value, and they're willing to express that financially. And if you lie to them about that, That's criminal. We know that. I think the same should be true about humanely raised animal products. There are people who are willing to pay more for genuinely humanely raised products, for dairy products, for example, that come from truly happy cows. For the California Milk Producers Association to say that California milk comes from family farms and happy cows, as they do in their ads, when it isn't true, strikes me as that should also be criminal. That should be seen as fraudulent, because it is. It's lying. It's deceptive. And it shouldn't be given a pass.
So their ads
shouldn't be allowed to do it.
Their ads are claiming that 99% of the state's dairy farms are family-owned, and you argue in the book that this is arrived at through a kind of a dishonest calculation.
Yes, it's arrived at by counting every... if you have one cow in the backyard, that's called a farm. And if you have 20,000 cows, that's called a farm. So if you had one of each of those, you could say 50% of the farms were family farms, and 50% weren't. But the fact is that 99.9999% of the cows would be from in the factory farm, and the numbers, in fact, they're saying something like 95% of the farms are in the state are family farms. But what they aren't telling you is that about 95% or more of the dairy cows in the state go live their entire lives in feedlots,
right,
that are corporate-owned, that are agribusiness, big ag at its worst.
Not to mention the ads were filmed in New Zealand,
yeah.
Not in California.
Yeah, the Happy Cow ads actually were filmed in Auckland, New Zealand, which is a real embarrassment to the California Milk Producers Association. I am sure they could have found one instance somewhere in this state, it's a big state, of a family farm that they could have photographed, but they didn't even bother.
Mm-hmm.
They actually filmed them in New Zealand, and that's been now publicized. I've been publicizing it, others have too. And it's embarrassing to them. I'm glad they're embarrassed. They should be ashamed.
You know, speaking of dairy, non-organic dairy, at least, one of the sections in your book is about the use of a BGH, bovine growth hormone.
Yes.
Do you have any sense of what percentage of California dairy farms are using this hormone?
Well, again, the real figure that you want to know is what percentage of California dairy products or California cows. It's not the number of farms, because size of the farms differ so much.
Right.
But it's over 50%, and of course it is the pig feedlot dairies that use it still. It's on its way out. It's turned out to be, it's a genetically engineered hormone that Monsanto developed that is injected into the cows. It produces mastitis. The udders get very large. It does produce more milk. The cows produce more milk when they've been injected with this genetically engineered hormone, but The cows also develop more udder infections called mastitis and other diseases, which Monsanto, by the way, provides antibiotics to the farmers to treat the infections that inevitably ensue when the farmers use the hormones that Monsanto sells them on their dairy cows. It's this endless loop, actually, of animals getting sicker and then more drugs being used. Sometimes I hear people say, well, it's too bad that the animals are treated cruelly in factory farms. But, you know, I have compassion fatigue. There's so much going on in the world that's terrible. And there's so many people suffering so badly. I can't extend too much concern to the animals. It's a shame, but it's too bad. But, you know, at least it produces cheap food, and that's a good thing. But actually, it's a little more complex than that, because when you treat the animals cruelly, when you frustrate their natures, when you violate their basic needs, as feedlots and factory farms do, the animals get sick. They're stressed very badly, and diseases spread under these conditions rapidly through the whole herd or flock. And so the industry then has to use more drugs to combat those infectious diseases. More antibiotics are used. And then the use of antibiotics in factory farms breeds antibiotic-resistant bacteria and undermines the value of antibiotics in our medicine, in human medicine. That is happening today. It's a very serious issue. We are well on our way to the post-antibiotic era, where the antibiotics we have depended on are losing their efficacy because we have bred resistant bacteria in our use of those antibiotics, through our use of those antibiotics in livestock raising. And there are other chemicals that are also used. We have pharmaceutical farms. And then residues from those drugs end up in the meats, in the dairy products, and the eggs that people eat. There is a direct correlation. The more cruel the conditions in which the animals are kept, the more confined they are, the higher the stocking densities, the more drugs must of necessity be employed, and then the more residues from those drugs end up in the products people are eating. The products are unhealthy. There's not just misery on the menu. There's drug residues as well that have been employed to combat the diseases caused by that misery. It is a very, very ugly system, and we really need to extricate ourselves from it entirely.
I'd like to talk a little bit about how people can make better choices, and I'd also like to conclude with a little bit of discussion about choosing not to judge people, but rather to kind of engage them.
Okay.
So people, let's say somebody wants to make a better choice, but they're kind of confused by a lot of the labels that are out there, and there's so many now with humanely raised, free range, of course, organic, grass-fed, all this different stuff. And, you know, I've heard both that free range means nothing and that, well, at least it's a little better.
With eggs, the industry standard has been to keep hens in cages. They're called battery cages in the industry parlance. They are, it's horrible. These are concentration camp eggs, and that's where most of, well over 95% of America's eggs today come from, those kinds of conditions. In California, we have legislation that goes into effect in a couple years that will require all the eggs sold in the state to be from cage-free chickens. But the industry is responding to this legislation. It is a step in the right direction. It's an important step. I supported that bill, by the way, very strongly. And the industry, true to its form, is developing ways of housing hens in warehouses that are cage-free technically, but are still egregiously merciless to these creatures. The next step then is free range, where the birds actually walk around outside and, you know, peck around on the dirt and see the sun and walk and do things like that. Unfortunately, there are egg factories that call their eggs free range, because they're in warehouses and there's a little door out to a little yard, but the birds never go through it because they're scared of the light, they're scared of the sky, they can hardly walk, sometimes they can't walk at all because of the conditions they've been raised in. There is not, with organic, we have certification. If it says it's organic, it almost certainly is. And there's very little opportunity for miscreants to deceive the public
What does that mean?
However, you can say it's natural. That doesn't mean anything.
But what does organic mean? If someone was to say choose organic,
that means it's certified organic.
But what is it?
Certification processes.
What does it mean for the chickens?
Oh well, for chickens, all it means is that the feed they were fed is organically raised. It doesn't say anything about the conditions in which the birds were kept. We don't have very good labeling. We don't have very good control over the labeling of eggs and poultry products today. That's something that needs to be addressed. For the consumer, free range is better, is the best, or pasture raised is another term, but it's the best. Second best is cage free. But again, how much reliability those terms have is an open question. Whole Foods is doing a pretty good job of actually policing their suppliers, and you can generally believe the labels on Whole Foods egg cartons. It's still a difficult task, though, and we need to have more control over it. The best thing is if you know the farmer from whom you're getting the egg, you can ask direct, specific questions and get them answered. There's a movement today. A lot of people are starting to have backyard hens. You know, it doesn't take a lot of space to have you know, a certain number of hens in a backyard and produce your own eggs. Or our neighbor can do it, or several people in a neighborhood can get together and do it together, and share the responsibilities and share the eggs. And that way they know exactly how the animals are treated and exactly what they're fed and exactly the conditions are, what those conditions are. And I'd like to see more of that. I would like to see more self-reliance in the food chain. I'd like to see us more producing more of our food, not just locally, but truly locally, the most locally thing of all, of course, being your own backyard.
Or second best, knowing the farmer that you're buying your eggs from.
Yes.
As you mentioned. What about grass-fed beef? A lot of people are turning to that because they see it as a more healthful and more humane solution. I know you don't have a lot of time, and plus you devote quite a bit of a space in the book to this topic, and people can get the book if they want to read more in depth on it. And again, the book is called No Happy Cows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Food Revolution, John Robbins' latest book. But if you could just address it briefly now, that
grass-fed is an improvement. Not as big as an improvement as we would like. One problem with it is that a grass-fed animal takes longer to mature, more months, even years, to come to market weight, which means that it spends more time eating and living per pound of food that it's flesh that it eventually provides to people. And what that means is that it eructates more methane. Eructation is the technical term. It's a combination of flatulence and commitment, but most of it actually comes out of the front end of the cow. These are animals who are ruminants. They have what we call four stomachs, and they produce methane. They are actually methane production factories. A great deal of the anthropogenic methane on the planet is actually produced through our ruminant animals, mostly cattle and cows and beef animals. And the result of that is that a pasture raised a grass fed beef animal produces more methane per pound of food than does a factory farm animal, a feedlot animal. So and in terms of the environment, in terms of global warming, this is a very significant greenhouse gas.
Well, not to mention the amount of land it would take to raise all of the animals that people are eating now.
Well,
on free range, it would be impossible to pasture raise.
Completely, utterly impossible. But, you know, we are eating way too much beef anyway for our health, for the health of our cardiovascular systems and for the planet, and not to mention the well-being of these creatures. If we ate much less, if we got much more of our protein and other nutrients from plant sources, if we ate a plant-strong diet instead of a meat-based diet, we would be able to create humanely structured animal product systems. We wouldn't be forcing and pushing to get every last ounce of or pound from these poor creatures as fast as possible. And we could adopt systems that were more respectful to their natures. And we wouldn't be eating nearly so much, and it would be a bit more expensive. But it wouldn't cost us so much because we'd be buying so much less. And we'd be much healthier, and we'd be much more caring people as a result, I think. We could look ourselves in the mirror a little more honestly and know that our lives were statements of our compassion for other creatures and instead of lives that were at the expense of and causing great suffering to other creatures. I think that would be a huge step for us.
So when it comes to beef, the ideal would be pasture-raised organic, which grass-fed is not necessarily organic, as you point out in the book. You can still have antibiotics and hormones, along with eating a lot less of it so that you know, we're able to actually do it in a pasture situation, which we couldn't now, raising as many animals as we are for food.
Yes, yes, that's exactly what I propose. And for some people to eat none at all, I don't eat any, and I'm very healthy. And many people make that choice, but that's a personal choice. I'm not telling people where to draw the line. What I'm saying is we need to move in a direction that's healthier, more sustainable, and more compassionate. And if we don't, we're going to kill ourselves, we're going to kill our spirits, and we're going to kill the earth. It's our choice.
I have a concern about the organic meat in that one of the things that the organic producers are not allowed to do is use antibiotics ever. If you go into Whole Foods, for example, in the meat section, they'll always say, no antibiotics, ever. And I have a little bit of a problem with that, because what if an organic grower has an animal get sick, or an organic farmer who's raising animals? They can't use antibiotics. They're forced to.
No, that's not correct. When it says no antibiotics ever, they mean no antibiotics are ever used prophylactically as growth promotants. See, 99% of the antibiotics used in contemporary livestock production are used as growth promotants. They're used preventively. They're mixed into every dose of feed the animal consumes.
I thought if they found a trace of antibiotics in the meat, it wouldn't be allowed to be organic, labeled
organic.
That's true.
But if the animal is ill, they can use the antibiotics to help the animal get well. Then there's a waiting period during which those traces are passed through their system, and then that animal can be returned.
Okay, I see.
And still be considered organic.
I see.
So if the animals aren't made to suffer in the organic standard. It's just that the vast majority of our antibiotic use in agriculture is not to heal or cure or treat sick animals.
So if people want to make the best choice right now with the system that we're in, you're saying go to the farmer's market, know the farmer, go for organic if you can, try to eat more of a plant-based diet if you're going to continue to eat animal products. Is that kind of essentially what you're saying? Go for cage-free
yes,
if you can.
Yes, and eat much fewer animal products. These terms like free-range and grass-fed don't have teeth in them. There's no certification. There's no certainty. That a producer displaying those terms on its product, there's no certainty what it actually means. We don't have requirements there. I'm not saying people are lying, but some of them are exaggerating. Some of them are marketing. Some of them actually don't care at all about it and just say it because it's profitable to do that. There is deception and there is a lot of confusion. Do the best you can, but don't fool yourself into thinking that, oh, it's all fine because it says cage-free, or it's all fine because it says humanely raised, or it meets some kind of egg industries. They've got their own standards that mean nothing. Certified Egg Producers Association standards, that means absolutely nothing.
Right. But taking steps in the right direction are some of the things you were talking about, like if you can grow some of your own food.
Of course, but I'm saying we also need to know which are the steps that are really going to make the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And for the consumer today, where you shop is a critical one, and eating a plant-strong diet, getting as much of your nutrient base from plants as possible. You'll get more phytochemicals, more antioxidants, more micronutrients. You'll be healthier.
What about people who are concerned that they're not going to get enough protein? That is a very common concern that people have that consider a vegetarian diet or a vegan
diet.
Well,
you can get plenty of protein from a vegetarian diet as long as you aren't eating junk food. If you're eating junk food, if many of your calories are coming from nutrient-deficient sources, then you might be protein deficient, but you will certainly be deficient in a lot of other essential nutrients as well. If you're eating wholesome food, if you're eating real food, you don't have to worry about your protein levels because plants are very high in protein, many of them. If you're willing to be most concerned, get tofu or other soy products or other legume products, beans and split peas and so forth. Are very high in protein. Whole grains are high in protein. Many vegetables are good protein sources. As long as you're not drinking Coke and eating cake and ice cream and you really don't have to worry about getting enough protein. It's a strange myth that has continued in our society that vegetarians risk being protein deficient. They actually aren't. There are very, very, very few cases of protein deficiency in this country. There are a few, but they're mainly alcoholics and other people whose diets are atrocious. But that's not really the problem we have to be concerned with. The problem we have to be concerned with in this society is excess cholesterol, excess protein, excess calories, excess fat, excess bad fats, trans fats, excess
protein.
We eat too much, and we eat too much of the wrong things, and we allow the junk food industry to market to kids the wrong things. We allow the government to make the wrong things, the least healthy foods, subsidize those, and those become the ones we feed our kids in schools. Those are the ones that are most prevalent and easiest and convenient to obtain and most inexpensive to obtain. Situation, quite frankly, ass backwards.
Yeah.
And there are, fortunately, there's a lot of people seeing it and revolting, and that's why we are having a food revolution.
You said excess protein. I think a lot of people would be a little taken aback by something like that. Like, you mean I can eat too much protein?
There's an old saying that a person with one watch knows what time it is. A person with two watches may not be quite sure. You can have too much of a good thing. And we definitely have many more cases in this country of people suffering from illnesses, particularly kidney diseases and many forms of cancer, that are caused or at least significantly contributed to by excess protein consumption than we do people suffering from illnesses linked to deficiencies of protein. The ratio is extravagant. We have far more people suffering from illnesses that are directly linked, if not caused, by excess protein consumption. Osteoporosis is one of those diseases. There are many forms of cancer that we know are accelerated by excess protein consumption. The numbers of diseases that are linked to deficiencies in proteins that exist in the United States today are very few. There are parts of the world where that's a problem, parts of Africa, for example, but those folks, sadly, are deficient in all their nutrients. They're not getting enough food. That's not usually the case here. We're eating too much of the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. In the last section of your book, which is titled Being Human in This Troubled World, you one of the things you write about is your concern for those close to you when they make food choices that seem less than healthy to you, and how you kind of approach that and how you handle those differences and your concerns. I'm wondering if you could just conclude by talking about how to be helpful without being judgmental is how you put it, I think.
Yeah, well, that's a big issue, I think. One of the bad reputations that vegetarians and vegans, for example, have is it's being more vegan than thou, righteous, self-righteous, judgmental, condescending, patronizing, insulting even. You know, we're talking it's presumably about adults. The people you're talking to are adults. Now, with your children, you do have a responsibility to see to it that they eat healthily. But if you're talking to adults, they're adults. They have the right to make their own choices. And you need to respect that. I think my rule of thumb is this. The more passionately I feel about a topic, and anyone listening to this interview knows I do about this, the more critical it is that I remember to remain respectful, truly, of the people whose actions are different than I might want them to be. Unless they're criminal, unless they're taking advantage of other people and hurting other people and violating other people's rights, that's different. But they don't have a right to do that, and I don't have to respect their right to do that. But people have a right to eat what they want to and to go to hell in their own chosen way if that's what they want to do. But I always want people to know the truth so they can make informed choices. I'm not asking people to be vegetarian. I'm not asking people telling people where they should draw the line. But most people actually have love in their hearts for animals, don't want to consume products from animals who've been tortured, as factory farm agribusiness does today. Most people want to eat a healthy diet if they can, if they know how to do it, if it's easy enough for them. doesn't cost an arm and a leg, and is tasty. We're shifting things in our culture so that we make that more easy for people, more convenient, more readily available. And that's a big thing. And so this work is on behalf of everybody, including those people who eat junk food. Because as we make the other healthy foods more available to them and easier for them to obtain, they'll shift. They may not be the pioneer, the person that goes forward first. Some of us are pioneers, and you can always tell the pioneer, they say, by the arrows in their back. Mm-hmm. But some of us are more courageous and do it earlier. Others are a little bit later to join in whenever others have proved it safe. But it's the responsibility of the pioneer to look back on to the others and say, come on, it's safe, it's fun, it's beautiful, it's loving, it's good here, rather than you're bad or wrong for not taking the step yourself.
So kind of talking with people rather than at them, as you wrote about in the book, when you saw a man berating a woman for her food choices, a mother in a checkout line, and then you said your first impulse was to reprimand him.
Yeah.
But instead you ended up having a conversation with him.
Yeah.
And it ended so much better than
it
would have.
Yeah, it did. And I did have that instinct or impulse at first. I felt very judgmental inside myself, but I didn't act it out. And you know, Martin Luther King, who was one of my mentors, and I marched with him and worked with him a lot, and he used to say that you have no moral authority with those who can feel your underlying contempt.
Mm-hmm.
So the more passionately I feel about a subject, the more important it is that I check those judgments, that I watch for them and not act them out, and genuinely respect all people, because that's the point here, is to live with respect for ourselves and each other.
I want to say this, even though I know I have to conclude, love the story, The Metamorphosis of a Pig Farmer. It was my favorite part. It's the opening of your book. It really blew me away. Not only the change in this person, but just the fact that you sitting quietly with him and listening to him and not reacting strongly to his initial attack kind of enabled him to get in touch with this part of himself that he had buried. And just, he had buried this in order to function at his occupation as a pig farmer in an industry that he had actually become very upset with some of the practices. And I guess maybe if you could, I don't want you to tell the whole story, but just maybe kind of conclude with your thoughts on that situation.
Well, we contend in our ignorance and in our alienation from farming to blame the farmers for the cruelty to animals that is endemic in modern meat production. Decisions at the mercy of economic forces and trends over which they have no control, and which they may even detest, as this pig farmer I write about did. We have to shift away from blaming the people who are oftentimes victims themselves of the system, and change the system, and not support those things that are bad, and instead nourish ourselves and spend our money on foods that are good, that are produced beautifully, and just withdraw our support from what we oppose. But we don't have to hate the people, and it doesn't help us, and it doesn't help them, and it doesn't help anybody to hate the people who are perpetrators of this cruelty. They need our compassion perhaps more than anybody. It's hard. It's hard to care for sometimes for people who are acting in ways that we see as causing great suffering. But we need to change the system so that isn't rewarded anymore. And we need to stop rewarding behavior that financially that is cruel. And I think we can do that. There's a lot of people wanting that, it's going to be difficult because the vested interests of big ag are tremendous. But I think we're going to take it a step at a time, a breath at a more earth-friendly choices, and bit by bit we're going to get there.
We've been speaking with activist and author John Robbins about his latest book, No Happy Cows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Food Revolution, a wide-ranging collection of essays on the state of food politics today. If you want more information about John Robbins, you can go to his website, which is www.johnrobbins.info, and in the back of the book, there's also a lot of resources. Thanks so much, John, for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So again, John Robbins' latest book, No Happy Cows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Food Revolution. It's published just this year. And as I mentioned in the beginning of the interview, he's the author of many other books, including The Food Revolution, Diet for a New America, Healthy at 100, Reclaiming Our Health, and The New Good Life. And his life and work have also been featured on a PBS special, Diet for a New America. You might want to try to check that out as well. Again, his website is www.johnrobbins.info for more information. Thanks for listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM.